The government would be authorized to arrest people in secret and not reveal that it even has them in detention.
No one in the British government contradicts the main messages that the White House is trying to deliver on Iraq.
What he did, he called for a peaceful transition of power over to the Iraqi people, but he said the U.S. knows that it has to leave and they better do it peacefully.
This issue has to be met head on, and it cannot be met in the context of an escalating defense budget, primarily because of the Iraq situation.
Our American foreign policy has promoted a repressive foreign policy, a regressive, profit-promoting foreign policy, and that's the root of terrorism.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, September 2nd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The brother of a cleric assassinated in a car bombing told 400,000 mourners today he blamed the U.S. occupation forces for the lax security that led to the attack of Iraq's most sacred Shiite mosque. We'll have more on that story in a moment. Also today, another car bomb struck police headquarters in central Baghdad, killing an Iraqi policeman and wounding at least 13 others in the latest attack, apparently targeting Iraqis working with the American-led occupation. L. Paul Bremer, the U.S. civilian administrator for Iraq, told a Baghdad news conference he shared the country's anguish over recent bombings, adding that it's a fight we're now going to have to win here, this fight against terrorism. The U.S. military also reported the deaths of three more American soldiers, two of them in the bombing of a convoy in southern Iraq. Democrat John Kerry, seeking to regain his political footing, formally launched his presidential candidacy today by offering his Vietnam War hero credentials and Senate tenure as an alternative to President Bush's record. Kerry told the crowd, "Every day of this campaign, I will challenge George Bush for fundamentally taking our country in the wrong direction." He said, "George Bush's vision does not live up to the America I enlisted in the Navy to defend." The Stars and Stripes announcement with the aircraft carrier USS Yorktown as a backdrop and Kerry's wartime comrades at his side comes at a critical juncture for the four-term U.S. senator from Massachusetts. Once viewed as a Democratic frontrunner in the crowded field of nine, Kerry saw that perception evaporate in the heat of party rival Howard Dean's summer surge. The political freefall has prompted a fresh round of finger-pointing in Kerry's deeply divided campaign and has the candidate considering a staff shakeup, according to several campaign officials who spoke on condition of anonymity. 400,000 Iraqi Shia Muslims filled the streets of Najaf, Iraq today, following the funeral procession of their assassinated leader, the Ayatollah Muhammad Bakir al-Hakim. Al-Hakim was killed along with more than 80 other worshippers when a car bomb exploded on Friday at the shrine of Imam Ali, one of Shia Islam's holiest shrines. The incident was widely regarded as a major crossroads in the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the bloodiest setback since it took power. As al-Hakim was laid to rest at his birthplace after a three-day funeral procession across the country, his brother, Abdelaziz al-Hakim, who's also a member of the U.S. PIC Governing Council for Iraq, delivered an angry eulogy denouncing the occupation, demanding that U.S. troops leave his country, and blaming U.S. forces for the lax security that led to the attack. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with journalist and Middle East correspondent Lamis Andoni about the attack on Friday. We began by asking her who she thought was responsible and what the motive might have been.
Well, it's difficult to tell. I know that most, including the U.S., is pointing fingers at the former regime, but I'm not sure who did it. It could be any group. There are many groups that are interested in provoking a civil war in Iraq, and Bakir al-Hakim had all kinds of enemies in the former regime, as well as he represents Iranian interests in the region and in Iraq, and that was a source of alarm to many people, including the U.S. We have to remember that Wolfowitz himself said the second day after the arrival of Bakir al-Hakim, the return of Bakir al-Hakim from Iran, and he was received by tens of thousands of people, that we didn't send our kids to war in order to have an Ayatollah rule. So it could be anybody. The most alarming part is if more of his followers get convinced that it was the followers of the former regime and the idea that is being conveyed by some people in the pro-American ruling council that it is the Sunni backbone of the regime that could provoke a civil war. And that's the most alarming part of the... Actually, it was a massacre, not just an assassination. 95 people were killed, at least, and many were wounded. So whoever did it did not only intend to kill him, the people who did it intended to provoke the Shiites. I mean, many people were angry at him for giving mixed signals about the occupation of Iraq. On one hand, he was against the occupation and he wanted the Americans to leave, but he was against the armed resistance. But his implied message had always been that we will try the peaceful way. The other element that's very important here is that it could have been a very militant group within the Shiite themselves or a very militant group that had nothing to do with the regime that was angry at him for collaborating indirectly with the Americans, meaning by not supporting the resistance against the U.S., especially even though in the Shiite areas there weren't as many armed attacks against American soldiers, in all of the demonstrations there were banners against America and Israel. The other factor is it could be somebody who's afraid of Iran and the Iranian influence in Iraq. And also it could be a Shiite group who wanted to send a message to the U.S. that they need their own militia. Mm. And if there is a Shiite militia, and now we already have a Kurdish militia in the north, that's the beginning not only of a civil war, but in the present situation, it could be part of a plan to liquidate the Iraqi state itself. That means Iraq would disintegrate into sects. Mm-hmm. Into enclaves for sex and ethnicities. And this is why we have to be careful when we say who did it. Because when we discuss who did it, it could be any party who is not interested in having a state in Iraq being resurrected.
So you've named about three or four different possibilities. You're saying it could be those afraid of Iranian influence. It could be someone that wants to have an armed militia within the Shiite population. Lemis, you said earlier that Wolfowitz made a statement after the invasion that said that, you know, we're not about to turn the country over to an Ayatollah. At the same time, however, isn't that fair to say that the Ayatollah was known for his cooperation with the U.S. forces and his continuing to call for restraint in the face of this ongoing violence?
Well, he did not take part in the war. What he did is that he called for a peaceful transition of power over to the Iraqi people, but he said that the U.S. knows that it has to leave and they better do it peacefully. So it's true, at the beginning, Wolfowitz said that, but the late Ayatollah was a shrewd tactician. He thought that if they did not take part in the Provisional Council, they would be left behind. And I don't think that his relationship with the U.S. was free of tension. I don't agree with that. I read the American media, and suddenly all of the American media is mourning him as if he was a great friend. That's not very accurate.
What effect do you think his assassination and this massacre, as you have characterized it, will have on the Ayatollah supporters?
Well, we have been seeing two kinds of effects in the last few days. One is people are blaming the U.S. for at least not protecting him, if not having it all, I mean his supporters, people who are being interviewed, and some, but so far they are a minority, who are calling for vengeance from the Sunnis. And this is the most, and this is what provoked many people to think that maybe it could lead to that the situation is very, very dangerous, that if it's not contained, it could lead to a civil war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I can say that some members of the council, of the Provisional Council, are deliberately fueling that, including the leader of the council, the chairman of the council for this month, Ahmed Jalabi. He's deliberately fueling this feeling. Mm-hmm. Because he, by insisting that he knows for sure that it was the followers of Saddam, he's fueling that, and especially that he's Shiite himself, this feeling, deliberately. Because he has an agenda. His agenda, as he wrote yesterday in the New York Times, is to have a total crackdown that is, close to what Sharon does in the occupied territories. He called yesterday in an article in the New York Times that the only way to get rid or to restore security in Iraq is by not only rounding up all of the former Baathists and the junior officials in the regime, but even their cousins and brothers and relatives, mm-hmm. and whole villages. And this is the man who is supposed to be the Pentagon's promise for democracy in Iraq.
Here in the U.S., some politicians are saying that this shows the U.S. needs to commit more troops to Iraq to preserve the peace and security. Others, however, are saying that the U.S. needs to pull all of its forces out of Iraq and let the Iraqi people determine their own political future. Still others are saying that we can't do that since that would create a vast power vacuum and the political situation would likely get even worse than it already has or than it already is without the U.S. authority providing at least some semblance of order. What do you think, Lamise and Oni, should be done at this particular point?
I think it should be really turned on to the UN, but not as an occupation. I mean, as a real UN role with full powers to enable the Iraqi people to elect their own leadership. But the U.S. is refusing that. It wants the UN to just provide a cover and human shields from other countries to protect its own troops because its own troops are being attacked. And that will not work. So it's not, the debate in the U.S. does not include a real role for the U.N., either a U.N. role on, as a cover for the U.S., as people like Friedman and Thomas Friedman and the New York Times and others are echoing, which is the State Department's line, which is like a U.N. cover, not really a role, but having the U.S. pick and choose. It doesn't work like that. The U.S. It either stops being an occupation and a real transition of power under real U.N. Auspices and according to international law, or it will continue like this, whether they set more troops or not.
Mm-hmm.
It will continue like this. I mean, anyone who has been to Baghdad lately knows, regardless of how people felt about the late regime, the collapsed regime, knows that the most of the anger is directed at America, and because people are being mistreated, because people are not convinced that the U.S. with all of its power and all of its technology cannot restore electricity to Baghdad, most of Baghdad, while as corrupt as the late regime was, I was there during the war in 1991, and it was able to restore the electricity after 3 days because the Iraqis have the qualified people to work on it. Iraq is not a country that didn't have electricity. It had electricity and it was advanced in technology. It was not. They're treating Iraq as if they came to a country that didn't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're lying. You know, students from all over the Arab world went to study in Baghdad and in Basra and in Mosul and all of Iraq. And now they cannot even restore electricity to Iraq. So I've met many Iraqis who have turned against the U.S. for feeling that they don't being treated with respect.
Lamise Andoni is a journalist for the British Middle East International newspaper. She lived in Iraq for a decade, but she spoke with us from Jordan. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, if you're finding yourself informed, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Well, from an analysis of the problems facing the U.S. occupation in Iraq, we're going to take a step back now to examine how the U.S. government, along with the American corporate media, built the case for the war on Iraq. With all the talk about weapons of mass destruction, Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke recently with Sheldon Rampton, co-editor of PR Watch, about his new book entitled Weapons of Mass Deception.
The war in Iraq was justified on the basis of three major claims. One is that Iraq possesses huge stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and possibly nuclear. The second claim was that Iraq was in cahoots with al-Qaeda, and this administration strongly insinuated that, in fact, Iraq played a direct role in the events of September 11. And the third claim was that American troops invading Iraq would be welcomed as liberators by the people of Iraq. In Weapons of Mass Deception, we analyze each of those claims and show how evidence was either selectively presented and interpreted, or in some cases outright falsified in order to create the impression that each of these claims was true, and in fact they were not. The other thing I think that is important to notice about the way propaganda got us into this war is that a lot of the techniques used to spread disinformation stop just short of being outright lies. Our chapter on these claims is titled True Lies, and that's for a reason. Shortly after September 11, Donald Rumsfeld was interviewed, and he was asked by a reporter if, in prosecuting the war on terror, if he would lie to the public in order to achieve his goals. And Rumsfeld responded by quoting Winston Churchill, said at one point that sometimes the truth is so precious that it must be accompanied by a bodyguard of lies. And then after quoting that rather dodgy statement, Rumsfeld said, the answer to your question is no, I can't imagine a situation. I don't recall that I've ever lied to the press. And he says there are dozens of ways to avoid having to put yourself in a position where you're lying. Well, what are those dozens of ways? A lot of those ways involve spreading very selective, distorted information that stops just short of being a lie, or planting lies through other parties or planting disinformation through other parties. And so a lot of the techniques that have been used to sell the war involve some kind of misdirection where the administration gets to come out at the end and say, well, we didn't quite lie, but they came awfully damn close.
Can you talk a little bit about what you think the mainstream pro-war perception is of why we went to war? As in, what was the final outcome? Did the propaganda war succeed, and if so, how?
Well, it certainly didn't. Opinion polls were conducted shortly before the onset of the war in March, in which pollsters interviewed Americans and asked them questions about their basic knowledge about fundamental facts, and they found that, for example, nearly half of the American people believed that Iraq played some role in the actual events of September 11, for which there's no evidence, but half of the American people believe it anyway. And nearly half of the American people also believed that some of the actual hijackers who flew the planes on September 11 were Iraqi citizens, which is also not true. None of the hijackers on September 11 was from Iraq. The reason that these impressions have circulated is because the media has functioned largely as an echo chamber for claims made by the Bush administration. So, for example, one story that we tell in our book is the story of Mohammed Atta, one of the September 11 hijackers. Shortly after September 11, rumors started circulating that Mohammed Atta had met in Prague with an Iraqi diplomat, and this was this story was investigated by the FBI, which reviewed hundreds of thousands of pages of information about Mohammed Atta's whereabouts, the whereabouts of the other 9/11 hijackers. They concluded that Atta had been in the United States during the whole period when this rumor suggested that he might have been in Prague. So there was no basis to the story. Also, the president of the Czech Republic, Václav Havel, investigated and came to the same conclusion and reported to the White House that there was no basis for the rumor. And yet, White House officials continued to bring up this alleged story about Muhammad Atta in Prague. When reporters asked him about it, they would, rather than saying, well, we know it's not true, they would say, well, that gets us into classified areas and we can't discuss it. And they would strongly insinuate that it was true without quite saying that it was true. And then the story got picked up by newspapers and on websites and all sorts of places, and it created this echo chamber effect. So you had people like William Safire writing in the New York Times and saying that an anonymous White House official has told him that the story is true. And, well, you never find out who that anonymous White Bush administration official is, but now you have the New York Times saying that it sounds like it's true.
It's a pretty sophisticated PR campaign. Can you talk about the way in which the White House very effectively used public relations corporations to treat the assault on Iraq like it was a new product launch, using business marketing strategies and the kind of spin that you saw in newspapers? What were some of the things that you found out about that?
The White House itself talked about the war as a product marketing exercise. White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card, for example, told the New York Times that they had waited until September of last year to begin trying to sell the war to the American people. And the reason, he said, is, well, from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August. One of the things that they did was they developed a team within the White House called the Office of Global Communications. They talked about ensuring consistency of messages about the war on terrorism. What this meant was that they had a daily set of message points that they sent out to U.S. embassies and sympathetic governments around the world by email. They called it the Global Communications Point. And it was just a series of bullet points. The idea was to make sure that no one working for a U.S. embassy somewhere, no one that was in the government, no one in the British government contradicts the main messages that the White House is trying to deliver on Iraq. The way they put it is they want to make sure that no one, not even Dick Cheney, freelances on Iraq.
What about this issue of how these PR firms have been using groups of third-party groups, if you will, to justify, to paint a veneer of authenticity to some of their spin? Can you talk in particular about the groups such as during the first Gulf War, Citizens for a Free Kuwait, and then this Council of American Muslims for Understanding, and even the Iraqi National Congress?
One of the longstanding techniques used by public relations firms to create and influence public opinion about an issue is what they call the third-party technique. The third-party technique means that you put your client's message in the mouth of some seemingly independent, credible third party. The reason you do that is because if the message is coming from your client directly, the public will recognize that it's a self-serving message, and they will be skeptical about it. So one good example of that you mentioned it, was Citizens for a Free Kuwait, which was supposedly an organization of American citizens who were concerned about freeing Kuwait from Saddam Hussein's grasp during the months leading up to the first war in the Persian Gulf, in which the United States participated, Operation Desert Storm. The reality is that Citizens for a Free Kuwait was actually funded almost entirely by the government in exile of Kuwait itself, which paid $14 million to a public relations firm called Hill & Knowlton to set up Citizens for Free Kuwait. And they did things like, you know, organizing rallies on university campuses and giving out T-shirts and putting together interviews on television. They put out video clips that showed information about Iraqi atrocities and so forth. And one of the things that they did was they arranged for a 14-year-old girl by the name of Nayira to give testimony claiming that she had personally witnessed Iraqi troops moving into Kuwaiti hospitals and pulling premature babies out of incubators so they could steal the incubators and leave the babies to die on the cold hospital floor. That's a claim that ended up being believed because it seemed to come from this credible third party, this young girl, Nayira, who said she'd been an eyewitness. In fact, what they didn't tell anyone was that this girl, Nayira, was the daughter of Kuwait's ambassador to the United States and Canada. And after the war was over, groups like Amnesty International that had believed this girl and repeated her claims investigated and found that there was no basis for the story. They didn't even have as many incubators in all of Kuwait as this girl had claimed she had seen being stolen. So, you know, doctors in hospitals said, you know, this was not true. This was just propaganda.
How would one, how would the average United States resident be able to see through this? You are very experienced in analyzing and studying PR campaigns. What advice can you give for the average listener and the average reader of a newspaper or watcher of network television to be able to see through the lies? Are there any patterns? Are there any tips that you can give us?
Well, there are a few things. One thing is to get your information from diverse sources. And fortunately, that's easier today than it has been in the past. If you have access to the internet, you can visit, you know, foreign news sites. In the final chapter of Weapons of Mass Deception, in fact, that's what we do, is we talk about the differences between the way the war in Iraq was covered in the American press as opposed to the European press and the Arab and Muslim press, and the differences are quite striking. The other thing that people can do that I think is helpful is if you just have an understanding of how the PR techniques work, which we try to explain in our books, then I think you can be a somewhat more skeptical consumer of what you see. You'll be a little more likely to expect bias to be in the media and to have a sense of what it might be. You know, there are other tips, too. For example, one of the things that's very common in propaganda is propagandists tend not to be very specific about facts. So if someone's reporting on a war, they might say it's going well, but they won't give specifics like body counts or exact locations where things happened. And a lot of propaganda tends to be vague on the details. And that's something to always be watching for when you watch the news.
Sheldon Rampton is the co-editor of PR Watch and the co-author of Weapons of Mass Deception. He spoke with Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles.
Hi, this is Jim Hightower. If you find what they do valuable, please make a financial commitment to Peace Watch so they can continue their work on your behalf. Kindly make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at pacifica.org. That's pacifica.org. Or you can send a tax-exempt donation via check or money order addressed to Peace Watch, care of Pacifica, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. Thanks a lot for your support, and I'll see you on the front lines.
Thank you, Jim Hightower. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.